Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, February the 19th. And I hope you'll join in as we discuss the latest on congressional efforts to pressure President Bush to change his Iraq war strategy. A bill, a non-binding resolution that criticized the troop surge plan in Iraq, did pass in the House on Friday, but the Senate did not vote on Saturday. As anticipated, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says now Democrats are going to continue to fight to get President Bush to change course in Iraq, but he says there will not be any more non-binding resolutions. He says now the Democratic-controlled Congress will turn its attention to measures designed to force a change. His comments came after the Senate Republicans' Saturday block debate on the non-binding resolution opposing President Bush's troop buildup. We'll talk about what's the next step? Cut off funding? Require more troop training? How about a resolution taking back the authorization for the war in Iraq? Will any of this do any good? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Or send your question or comment for our guest via email, talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is, and we are happy to have him with us, Sandy Mazel, a professor of government at Colby College and director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement. Among many books, he is the author of Parties and Elections in America, The Electoral Process, and Running on Empty, Political Discourse in Congressional Elections. Good morning.
Good morning, Joyce. Glad to be back with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. So this was not unexpected that the House on Friday would pass this non-binding resolution, but not as many Republicans as expected joined Democrats?
No, there are only 17 Republicans who voted with the Democrats on the vote in the House on Friday, and two Democrats actually voted with the Republicans. So there was a shift of 15. There were a couple of absences.
Yeah, what does that tell us?
Well, it means that there's a great deal of support for the president still in the Republican caucus and the Republican conference in the House, that the apparent public dissatisfaction with this escalation or surge or augmentation or whatever word you want to try to find a non-biased word to use has not translated to the members of Congress. And also that I think the way that the non-binding resolution was worded, which was designed, frankly, to get Republicans to be comfortable with it, didn't have that effect.
Yeah. And then on Saturday, the Senate doesn't vote because, tell us what happened there. Republicans blocked this vote somehow.
That's right. The Senate, in order to proceed to a vote on a piece of legislation, it needs 60 votes. It's you can essentially talk a bill to death. It's called cloture unless 60 senators, three-fifths of those elected, vote to end debate. And in this vote, there were only 56 who voted to end debate. It's sort of interesting. In the history of the Congress, going back to the early period, certainly, and most of the time, and particularly in the 1950s, filibusters were used only for very major pieces of legislation. In the last two decades, in this highly partisan era, polarized era in Congress, they've been used more and more frequently as a way to say for any major piece of legislation you need 60 votes. And instead of sort of having the filibuster and then eventually having a cloture vote, the procedure now is to say, okay, we're going to have a filibuster unless you can tell us that you have 60 votes to end the filibuster. So you sort of shortchange the technique. To me, it means that what the organization that builds itself as the world's greatest debating society fails miserably in carrying on the kind of debates that we had come to anticipate in the Senate.
Yeah. The Republicans were mad at the Democrats for not allowing a vote on an alternative measure that would have ruled out any funding cuts. Talk about that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. This is a number of the senators really hit the nail on the head in this. This was very partisan on both sides of the aisle. The Democrats wanted this vote to say that they had lived up to their pledge during the campaign to do what they could to end the war and to say to the president that we, the Senate, the people, the House, are against this war. The Republicans saying no, that in fact what you're truly trying to do is embarrass the president. If you want to end the war, have a resolution that will end the war, that deny funding or something like that, and that this piece of legislation is really just an attempt to embarrass the president. And they had an alternative piece of legislation which says, which said essentially, we're not going to take the ammunition and arms from the boys and women, men and women in the field. And the Democrats didn't want to vote on that. The Republicans are exactly right in this, because it would have had somewhere between 70 and 75 votes in favor of it, more votes than the Democrats' resolution. And it would have led to a dilution of what the public sentiment was on this. And in fact, what both votes reflect, I guess, in my view, is there is some confusion in what the public feels on this. If you look at the latest polls, and there haven't been any polls taken, at least there haven't been any polls that I've seen taken since these two votes, but there was an AP Ipsos poll taken just as the House vote was going on. A majority of the American people, about two-thirds of the American people, don't want a vote to cut off the funds, and they, in fact, don't want a vote to cut off the funds if there is a surge. On the other hand, the same percentage don't want the surge.
Yeah.
In some ways, the Congress is reflecting that.
Yeah, in fact, we did an open line program on this last week, and that a lot of people want Congress to do something, but Congress can only do so much. It can cut off funds, right? That's what it can do.
The Congress really can't cut off funds. The Congress can only cut off funds if two-thirds of the congressmen vote for it, because if fewer than two-thirds vote for it, the president will veto the bill. And there's nowhere near two-thirds of either house that favors that. There's probably not a majority of either house that favors that. So it really isn't. In some ways, what the Republicans are presenting is an alternative that isn't there. And what the Democrats are faced with is no effective means of expressing their support. Now, they are looking around for new means. And there are two that are being floated right now, each of which I find quite interesting. In the House, Congressman Murtha, yep, is looking at an appropriation bill which essentially says we will only send additional troops to Iraq, and I think it says in Afghanistan as well, I'm not sure, but we only send additional troops if they are well enough rested, well enough trained, and well enough equipped.
Knowing that they might not be.
Knowing that by the standards that he is setting in that bill, they are not. Mm-hmm. And the president has said he would veto that bill. That's going to put the president in a very difficult situation. In the Senate, Senator Biden, who was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, one of the senior Democrats in the Senate, and a presidential candidate, and I think you should never forget the terms presidential candidate because there are so many of them in the Senate, and I think their candidacies affect what they're saying. But Senator Biden, who voted for the resolution to go to Iraq, is now introducing a piece of legislation which would essentially rescind that resolution to go to Iraq, and that would be another way in which they could express their opinion.
But is it just expressing opinion, or does it carry any weight? Does it mean anything?
Well, that one, both of them are I think, carry weight if they are passed. The Murtha bill, if it is passed, essentially puts restrictions on what the president can do. I think he would veto that bill. Whether there are two-thirds who would favor it is a serious question. Mm-hmm. But it certainly, if it were to pass, would place serious restrictions on the way in which the president acts as commander-in-chief, and I think it might set up a confrontation between the president and the Congress over his powers as commander-in-chief. The Biden bill would take away the authority to do what the president is doing, and again, that's never been tested. I think, again, it would set up a confrontation, but the president would certainly lose the line that he has had, which says, essentially, the Congress voted for me to do this, because the Congress would then be voting for him not to do this.
Let's see what listeners think of these two new bills, one that would rescind authorization for the war in Iraq, one that would restrict the troops that could be sent to Iraq, making sure that they are well-trained and well-rested. What next, now that the House did pass this non-binding resolution criticizing the buildup of troops in Iraq, and the Senate did not pass this? It did not come to a vote. Republicans blocked a vote in the Senate on Saturday. talking about the politics of Iraq and congressional efforts to somehow force the White House to change its strategy in Iraq. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 20 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, February the 19th. Peter Donalds is in for Kathleen Dunn this morning, and after 10, he'll be welcoming in the former Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, and his wife, Janet. And they'll talk about how they, as a diverse couple, have overcome the barriers of racial bigotry and found happiness together. They are the authors of Love in Black and White, coming up after 10 o'clock this morning. We're talking about the politics of Iraq. On Friday, the House passed a non-binding resolution on Iraq. On Saturday, the Senate was in, hoping to pass, at least Democrats were hoping to pass the same non-binding resolution, but Republicans blocked a vote on it. Now the Senate Majority Leader says that no more non-binding resolutions. We're going to turn our attention now to bills that will force a change. We're talking about some of those bills with our guest and welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest is Sandy Mazel. He is a professor of government at Colby College in Waterville, Maine. He is the director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs. And our first caller for him is Sarah in Pell Lake. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Great show. I'm a little confused, and I was hoping your guest could help me straighten this out. Now, I thought Congress could only enact a war. With that being said, once the war started, can the president then call up the troops, or does Congress have to be in session to say, yes, no more troops are needed for the war, or does this fall into the fact that Congress gave the president extra powers at the beginning of the war, and is he able to call up because of that? I'm just trying to figure out where Congress is, where the president's powers end and Congress's begin in this kind of situation?
That's a great question, Sarah. Thank you. And you are not the only person who's confused. I think there's some major confusion in Washington on this as well, and has been for some time. Congress, according to the Constitution, has the power to declare war. Mm-hmm. The president has the power, essentially, to make war, because he is the commander-in-chief, also, according to the Constitution. We rarely have declared war. In fact, the last time we declared war was World War II. Neither the Korean War nor the Vietnam War was ever declared. They were both actions under international agreements. In the first case, the United Nations. In the second case, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. And in other cases, Lebanon, the first Iraq War, this Iraq War, Congress has essentially acceded the power to the president by passing a resolution which saying under certain circumstances he can do this. There's serious question, obviously, today about the amount of evidence that Congress had when they passed the resolution allowing this Iraq war to start. There is even more serious question once troops have been committed what the president can do. There is a piece of legislation in the book called the War Powers Act, passed during the Vietnam War over the veto of President Nixon, which seeks to restrict what a president can do short of a declaration of war. It has never effectively been tested in courts, and every president, Democrat and Republican alike, since its passage, have felt that it's unconstitutional, but they've never gone to the point of testing it.
Yeah. Professor Mazel, any comments on how the White House is reacting to all of this in Congress? Essentially, it seems the president has just resolved that Congress was going to debate this non-binding resolution and kind of ignoring it.
I think that's right, and really sort of an in-your-face kind of ignoring it. The president has said in almost these exact words, we're going ahead no matter what they do, that they can't do that. And that's why I said in my earlier remarks that I think there very well may be a constitutional confrontation between the Congress and the president if the Congress takes some authoritative steps, because I think the president won't accept them.
Thanks, Sarah, for the call. Mike in Appleton is with us now. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for your guest comments. It's very interesting from an academic point of view. However, personally, I have no good opinion about what's going on in Congress. And to your guests and to the listening public in general, let me just paint very quickly the following scenario. Somehow, we remove ourselves from Iraq and, of course, create a vacuum. That vacuum is filled by Iran, and they take control of the region. They're on the border with Saudi Arabia and other oil-producing states. In a couple of years, they acquire a nuclear weapon, and a little bit further down the line, they say, okay, now oil is $200 a barrel, and so we're paying $10, $15 a gallon of gas at the pump. The then president is facing economic meltdown, and what does he do?
Yeah, so that's the scenario you think is going to happen.
I think it's a probable scenario. At least it's certainly a possible scenario.
Yeah.
And I think the actors in Congress, I think they're highly irresponsible by not voicing what is a possible scenario in which all of us are going to face some real hardships.
Well, it hasn't been maybe expressed exactly like that, Professor Maisel, but that's what some Republicans are saying.
I don't think that's very far from what the most critical Republicans have been saying about this. That the reason we can't get out, we can't do what the Democrats are saying, is because of the consequences after that happens. And I don't think they're quite as dire as our guest predicts, but I think most of them are saying they're quite dire. What the Democrats and the critics of the president will respond is, even if you grant that, there is no evidence that they can see that this 21,500 troop augmentation is going to change that scenario. So that if you fear that scenario, come up with an alternative short of one that is, what, again, I'm only stating the critics' point of view. I'm not necessarily stating mine. Paint a scenario short of one which is likely to lead to much more American bloodshed, with no evident result that is going to have the desired effect that you want. And they say that involves beginning with serious dialogue with the people who we don't talk to, particularly Iran and Syria.
Yeah. And then we heard some of the White House and some Republicans saying, let's give this troop augmentation
right.
a chance. And, hey, look at this. They're pointing to the relative peace for the past few days until yesterday.
That's right. And the president's argument is people are voting against this and talking against this before they've even seen whether it has a chance to work, and they are trying to paint a scenario in which this is different from what we tried to do last July when we extended the period in Iraq of 30,000 American troops, 172nd Striker Battalion and others, to try to calm Baghdad. But the critics' response to that is there's no logical rationale why we think this should work, and every time you have said this before, it has failed, and you have said this to us without giving full information. And I think one of the serious questions that has come up in this debate is whether the way in which the administration, not just the president, but the entire administration, has handled giving out information to the Congress has cost the president credibility, so that the perfectly logical argument that he is making now might well have been accepted 2 years ago. But there have been so many rosy scenarios painted and everything saying everything is just, happy as can be since mission accomplished, that the president has lost his credibility with the Congress, including with some of the Republicans in Congress. One of the most interesting parts of that debate to me, what we talked about was that only 17 Republicans voted with the Democrats. Who the 17 were was fascinating to me because they were not from the swing states. They tended to be from very red Republican congressional districts, people like Jimmy Duncan from Tennessee, a very conservative Republican congressman who said, I am sick and tired of people profiteering from this war without getting information from the White House. Or Wayne Gilchrist, another conservative Republican from Maryland, who said, because his district is close to Washington, he has made a point of going to the funeral of every constituent of his who has died in Afghanistan or Iraq, nearly two dozen now, and he said, I can't tell them anymore that I think this is going to work. And it seems to me that's a very different kind of thing than went out in the Senate when most of the Republican senators who voted with the Democrats were people who are up for re-election this time in close districts.
Well, just FYI, one Republican from Wisconsin's Tom Petri from Wisconsin is
Illinois, yeah.
Tom Petri is from the 6th Congressional District in Wisconsin. a Republican. He voted with all of the Democrats in Wisconsin's congressional delegation. Tammy Baldwin, Steve Kagan, Ron Kine, Gwen Moore, Dave Olby, all voting for this non-binding resolution criticizing the troop surge. Tom Petri, the lone Republican voting with the Democrats, voting no, Paul Ryan and James Sensenbrenner. We are talking with Sandy Maisel. He is a professor of government at Colby College, director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs, talking about the politics of Iraq, the congressional efforts to put some pressure on President Bush to change his Iraq war strategy, talking about the non-binding resolution that did pass the House on Friday, the a failed attempt to vote on this resolution in the U.S. Senate on Saturday, and now some of the other options before Congress, including perhaps a bill that would somehow rescind the authorization for the use of force against Iraq. Should Congress pass something like that, rescind the authority to go to war in Iraq? Would that make a difference? How about this Jack Murtha bill that would require more training for troops sent to Iraq? What do you want to see Congress do regarding the war in Iraq? How about the defunding? Senator Russ Feingold has authored a bill that would defund this surge, but it doesn't necessarily have the support of two-thirds of Congress. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Before we go to more calls, Professor Maisel, what's your best prediction as to what Congress is going to do next?
I think the Democrats are going to move slowly, but methodically on some of the legislation that Congressman Murtha is putting forward in the House. I guess I honestly think in the Senate you're going to see a lot more rhetoric and pomp and probably no vote on the Biden resolution. The Democrats will push it. I have frankly been quite disappointed with the quality of the debate in both the House and the Senate in that they seem to be talking by each other, not to each other, and speaking to the press gallery and to the C-SPAN audience. Mea culpa, I am a C-SPAN junkie, as opposed to trying to talk to each other in the House debate. The chamber was basically empty during most of the debate, even though nearly 400 members spoke. Nearly 400 members spoke. In the Senate debate, the attendance was intermittent. They really weren't listening to each other. It's a question of who's going to win and the gotcha. And I think that's too bad in the Senate. In the House, because the rules favor the majority party, there's much more likely to be action.
Yeah. I was seeing some Indiana Republican Richard Lugar saying that President Bush might, help himself if he would ask Democrats for their thoughts on the Iraq war and developed a bipartisan policy. And I was thinking, well, isn't that what the Iraq Study Commission was all about?
Well, I mean, that's what the Democrats are arguing, that in fact he he said prior to the midterm election that he was not going to take any action, waiting to the results of the Iraq study group. And then he said he would listen to the generals. He clearly rejected most of the results of the Iraq study group and fired the generals who didn't give him the answers that he wanted and put in place those who believed in his policy. Now, as commander-in-chief, he has a right to do that. There's no question. But it seems counter to what he said before. And I think it's terribly frustrating for the Democrats who are in fact looking at a situation when it's very hard to figure out where they're going to, where they're going to have an impact.
Let's go back to the phones. Mike in Cottage Grove, hi, you're on the air.
Well, Professor, what I find interesting is the Democrats are not trying to have a real strategic impact or a policy impact. This is all about politics. This is about them winning the presidency. It's always been about them being in political power. There's not one Democrat who's yet to offer, even our Senator Russ Feingold, has never once offered a coherent strategy about what we do. The closest they've come is suggesting, and then they backed away from it, negotiating with our additional enemies, the Syrians and the Iranians, who sponsor terrorism worldwide. I mean, the reality is, are the Democrats prepared to cave in on Israel? Are we prepared to back away from Israel? Because the reality is, in that region, the only thing that will satisfy most of these people is for the United States to turn its back on the people of Israel. And what really frustrates me is to listen to Democrats constantly demagogue this issue, and we all know it's just simply to get them elected president. And I think they're going to find out in 2 years if they keep this up. George Bush is a problem, yes, but Democrats will be thrown out of office.
Hmm. Is that where this is going?
That's an interesting question. I don't, in some ways, I think the caller might be surprised at this. I don't disagree that the Democrats are demagoguing the issue in some ways. I also think the Republicans are demagoguing the issue. I think both sides are. I do disagree on 2 points. First of all, it is incumbent, it seems to me, on the administration to come up with a policy that has the backing of the American citizenry. You can't. We learned in Vietnam that you cannot run a war if the American public is against it, and that isn't the role that the opposition has ever had to play. It is the role that the administration has to play. That having been said, in fact, I think some Democrats have made specific proposals. Senator Biden has a very specific proposal. I'm not sure I agree with his proposal, which is essentially a gradual partitioning of Iraq with a very weak central government and a Kurdish section, a Sunni section, and a Shia mm-hmm. section. And he acknowledges the difficulty and the problems in that, and moving in that direction, but that's an alternative to what's happening in Iraq, as opposed to no alternative. And a number of the presidential candidates have begun to express their views on it. I do think, and I agree with the caller, that if we're in this situation 6 months, 9 months from now, and somebody's interested in running for president, they have to have an alternative, because then it will be clear we're going to be in the same situation when they take over. That the opposition party in the Congress has to have an alternative, I think, flies in the face of 230 years of American political tradition.
Yeah, so it's not a strategy to say we just need to have an orderly withdrawal, maybe move troops out of Baghdad into Afghanistan and around the borders. That's not a.
I don't think so. I agree with the caller on that. Mm-hmm. That is not a strategy that deals with the long-term regional instability. And I also agree with the caller that it is very clearly connected to the role of Israel as a free and independent nation, and that we are not, in fact, going to abandon Israel. Whether we are continuing to be willing to be critical of Israel is a more serious question. I think we should, and I think we have been under the Clinton administration in the beginning of this administration, in the first Bush administration. It seems to me that a strategy to end the war is one thing. A strategy of what one does to bring some semblance of stability to the Middle East is a very different thing. I also, by the way, disagree that because we have serious problems with both Syria and Iran, we can't speak to them. We also have serious problems with North Korea, and we are speaking to them.
Yeah. Any thoughts on back and forth last week about whether Iran was the top levels of the government supplying weapons that were killing American troops in Iraq?
I thought Press Secretary Tony Snow on I think it was Meet the Press yesterday, came up with a new level of parsing words.
Right.
He came down to the point with saying the only disagreement that he had with Peter Pace, the chief of staff, is whether it was the top two or three people in the Iran government as opposed to anybody in the Iran government. I think this is another example, a very clear example, of where the president and the intelligence community's credibility has been threatened because of what we know they did in the run-up to the war. And when the data was presented in that sort of oblique way with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff essentially saying, I don't think we have any evidence, mm-hmm. the administration saying we do, it can only lead to more cynicism by the American public. And for anyone to be surprised, as we've known, by the way, since 2003, for anyone to be surprised that Iran is supplying arms to people in Iraq is sort of the height of hypocrisy. They've known this all along, and that's part of what's going on in this region.
Yeah. Ken in Neillsville is with us now. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I just have a few points to make. First of all, I mean, if you go back to your last caller, he said that Democrats don't have a plan. First of all, the Republicans were completely wrong on the invasion of Iraq. The administration was completely wrong. They've made mistake after mistake. They did not listen to the generals or the, high-ranking officials in the military or in the Pentagon. And anybody that disagreed with them, they totally got rid of. Now they want to sit here and criticize the Democrats for not having a plan.
Well, it was the administration that falsified evidence to invade Iraq to begin with. And they're making mistakes. They're treating our veterans and the military badly. I mean, they're trying to cut veterans' benefits and trying to cut the combat pay from the soldiers over there. And then, you know, anytime a soldier or whatever wants to voice his opinion, then they want to shut him up.
Yeah, so
this is just...
You don't think, Ken, that the Democrats have to have a plan? They should just get troops out of Iraq. That's all.
They do have a plan. Hillary Clinton has a plan. Biden, as you said, has a plan. Most of the Democrats have a plan. But since they don't control the House or the Senate,
well, yes,
you know,
they do.
Nobody listens to them.
Oh.
Wait.
Yeah.
They do control the House.
They control both.
Yeah, but when they invade... when they invaded Iraq, they didn't control the House and the Senate. They control the House and the Senate now, but now that the administration doesn't want to listen to anybody, regardless of what party they are anyway.
Yeah. Professor Maisel, do the Democrats really have to have some sort of a long-term plan for peace in the entire Middle East in order to withdraw troops from Iraq?
No, I don't think they do, but I think, going back to the caller before last, I think that presidential candidates have to address the entire region, not just what's happening in Iraq. And it's very tempting politically just to talk about Iraq, but that doesn't deal with the long term problem. Part of the long term problem is conservation. It's our dependence on Middle Eastern oil. So I don't think it is. It's an easy solution. But I feel very strongly that the Democrats in the Congress don't have either the obligation to do that or the power to do that. The Democrats who are going to be the final candidates running for president, I think, do.
Yeah, let me take a short pause and remind listeners we are talking with Sandy Maisel. He is a professor of government at Colby College and the director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs. He is the author of many books, including Parties and Elections in America, The Electoral Process, and Running on Empty, Political Discourse in Congressional Elections, talking with us about Congress and Iraq. The non-binding resolution that passed in the House did not come up for a vote in the Senate on Saturday, and where Congress goes from here in trying to change strategy in Iraq. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, Peter Donald's in for Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock. And according to a recent study by UNICEF, Britain and the United States ranked last among wealthy nations for child welfare. Peter Donald's and his guest will talk about why that is coming up after 9. We're talking about politics and Iraq and Congress. Senate Democrats now saying they might try to restrict President Bush's ability to wage war in Iraq. Armed Services Committee Chair Carl Levin told Fox News Sunday that the Senate could try to approve a more limited version of the 2002 measure that authorized the use of force against Saddam Hussein. Levin says that could narrow the mission and remove U.S. troops from the middle of a civil war. That plan also supported by Joe Biden, talking on Face the Nation yesterday. Biden says he's been working to convince others to support this idea to rescind the authorization for the war. But Republican Richard Lugar said on the same program he didn't think the idea has enough support to pass. And I'm wondering, Professor Maisel, is that your read on the situation right now, too, that rescinding the authorization for war doesn't have enough support to pass?
I don't think it has enough support to get debated. I mean, I think it has enough support to pass. I think you'd get 56 votes. I don't think you'd get 60, and therefore there would be the same resolution would be filibustered and wouldn't come to a debate in the Senate. Mm.
Donna in Menominee is our next caller. Hi, Donna.
I just wanted to note that there seems now to be a general assumption that this is indeed long-term about oil, even though everybody who was in favor of the war denied that heartily at the beginning. And also to point out that people are afraid of an economic meltdown if the price of oil goes too high, and it seems to me that we expect the Middle East to give us their oil at a price which will not seriously inconvenience us, as though that's some sort of right, when the reality is we need to seriously reduce our dependence on Middle Eastern and all other kinds of fossil fuels in the next 10 years, or we're going to have a planetary meltdown.
A reaction, Professor Maisel?
Well, I think the caller is right, that there is a, you know, a part there. At least two parts of our commitment to the in the Middle East. One is about oil; the other is about Israel, and you know, sort of the general human rights questions in the Middle East. And I think those should be separated. Our dependence on foreign oil has gone up significantly during 6 years of the Bush administration, despite a pledge that it wouldn't when he came in. There was another pledge in the State of the Union this year by the president. And I think it's a very important issue that the caller raises, that until we reduce our dependence on foreign oil and until we reduce our dependence on fossil fuels generally, we're going to still be in this same kind of situation. But that's also not a short-term solution. It's a long-term solution.
Thank you, Donna. Don in Madison is with us now. Hi, Don.
Good morning. Yes, I was wondering, why is the situation so different in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan? And then why can't something similar be done with the rest of Iraq?
Yeah, they just had something on 60 Minutes on that last night.
Yeah, it is interesting. There was a thing on 60 Minutes. The Kurds, the situation is different in northern Iraq, but not necessarily long-term stable. And let me see if I can just quickly say why. The situation in southern Iraq is largely, right now, sectarian violence, mostly between Sunnis and Shias, and among various factions, particularly Shia factions, who are warring with each other and who all view our presence negatively. In northern Iraq, the Kurds had been very badly treated by Saddam Hussein and basically had been left alone, except for around the area of Kirkuk, since Saddam Hussein left power. But the problem of northern Iraq, the long-term problem may be that the Kurds in what is now Iraq would rather be part of a nation of Kurdistan with the Kurds in Turkey, another U.S. ally. And that's, you know, one of the things that Senator Biden has pointed out is a complication of his proposal that you have to think through and figure out what you're going to do. But probably the clearest evidence of the fact that this is a civil war is the fact that the Kurds have not been involved in it.
Thank you, Don. Leroy in Holman is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. But Professor, correct me if I'm wrong. I think when Colin Powell, during the first Bush administration, or at least the first term, suggested an international community, an international conference, rather, for that region to discuss the situation, especially the Arab-Israeli conflict, because for 50 or more years, the international community has probably failed these two communities in trying to resolve this two-state solution issue. And until we can come and address this problem, wars are not going to solve the problem, because as you see, the Arab-Israeli conflict is the center point for which all these actions, whether it is the Iraq war or the invasion of Kuwait by the Iraqis. And so I'm saying, when they talk about the Democrats not having a solution, this is one good solution. Let's call an international conference and address this issue. America cannot be an honest broker in this when she continues to take the side of the Israelis, and the Europeans cannot be. So let's get other people who are maybe free thinkers who can come and give leadership. I know the UN, too, has lost credibility in terms of trying to be the honest broker. So we can find a kind of neutral party that will be able to address such a conference. And I think the Scandinavians are very good when it comes to these kinds of things.
All right. What do you think of Leroy's proposed solution?
Well, I guess one of the things I tell my students is if there were an easy solution to any political problem, somebody would find it and come up with it. There's not going to be an easy solution. There's not going to be a honest broker. In fact, we had the Middle East peace talks in Scandinavia during what the Carter administration, I guess, that comes up with a solution people are happy with easily. Look at how long it took Senator Mitchell simply to come to a ceasefire in Northern Ireland, and that is still, you know, not necessarily stable. So I think he's right. We have to do this. I think the United States has lost credibility with some factions in the Middle East because of support for Israel. I think that for all sorts of reasons, we are not going to abandon that, and we're not going to give up our right of sovereignty to take that situation. But, in fact, you have to find a solution in the Middle East. I also think, and this shouldn't be lost, that the role that Israel plays in the Iraq situation now is really to inflame Muslim anger against the United States, much more than it deals with Israel specifically. It is a flashpoint more than it is a policy question.
Yeah, and if the U.S. Denounced support for Israel, many would say that's not going to stop the radical Muslims from attacking us.
Absolutely, and it's also not going to stop the Sunni Shiite conflict, mm-hmm. which is based in disagreements over Muslim theology.
Yeah, thank you, Leroy, for the call. Brian in Oshkosh, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
Hi. Yes. Yeah, I think a lot of this is all, political, of course, and a lot of this, I think, is run by the media. No one really knows exactly what's going on in Iraq except for the military, in Iraq. And a lot of these operations, some covert operations and just, aren't revealed, to the media. And I think the media is making a big deal out of this. I believe I've heard that, the media, is run by the liberals, and the Democrats, they're running early for presidency. That's a big battle between getting in office and everything.
Yeah, I'm Brian, so...
I guess I'm unconvinced by that argument for a couple of reasons. The media is not making up the over 3,000 American deaths. It's not making up the bombing in Baghdad yesterday when 60 more people were killed. Mm-hmm. The fact that major city in Iraq is basically unlivable. I understand the military are doing things that we don't know about, but the result is pretty clear for everybody to see. And, the caller's right. We have started a presidential campaign earlier than ever before, but the real reason for that is the political calendar is moving faster, and the fact that this is the first time since 1928 when both parties have a totally open nomination, no sitting president or vice president seeking the nomination of either party. And that has led to the early presidential campaign in both parties, not just in the Democrats.
Thank you, Brian, for the call. Let's go next to Joe in Hudson. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Yeah, I am very upset with the administration. I'm a Republican, that they just disregard the veterans. They're sick when they come home. They can't get care. The families are they need help. Some of them are just poverty stricken. I have friends that have been wounded and are suffering from the shock. They can't get into the Veterans Administration. It's a mess.
Yeah, that's a kind of a different issue, though, Joe. But I'll get our guest to respond. What do you think about what Congress is trying to do to try to get the president to change his strategy in Iraq?
Well, I know what I think. Mm-hmm. Take care of the buddies at home. As my veterans friend said, I'm an old, dirty piece of meat. You can spend all the money in bombing Iraq, but you can't take care of me.
Yeah.
Well, I think the caller's comment is related to mm-hmm. a number of things that are going on in Washington, which is the extent of the money that is being spent on this war is coming out of other places, including the way we're treating veterans, and including, by the way, the preparation of our own military, both to go into this war and to be ready for other kinds of actions. And I thought it was interesting that he prefaced his remark by saying that he's a Republican. If I were a Democrat in Congress right now, I would basically say, we're not going to be effective until the Republicans march on the White House and say that, we don't believe in what you're doing. I think that's really the situation the Democrats are in. You can pass all the non-binding resolutions you want. You can demonstrate that the majority of the American people are against the president. But until Republicans march to the White House and say, this is not the way we should be going, I don't think we'll see a change.
Thank you, Joe, for the call. Sarah in Plymouth. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if I had heard before that through state sovereignties, the governors of each state would have the right to suspend sending National Guard to Iraq. And I was just wondering if that would be feasible either through a proposed amendment to the people to vote on it, to not at least send the Wisconsin troops, and that would send a message to the nation and maybe other states would follow suit.
I think that's a really interesting kind of. I think the broader question you're raising is what can people in various states do, And I don't know the situation in Wisconsin, but the main National Guard and main reserves are stretched to their absolute limit. And our governor has expressed that to the national commandant of the National Guard and of the reserves. And I think that that's something we have to be very, very concerned about. You know, the lack of response to Katrina was partially because of the fact that the Louisiana National Guard was deployed in Iraq at the time, large portions of it.
Yeah. You know, Professor Maisel, I'm just wondering when all is said and done and not debated, as you mentioned is likely the case, and especially in the Senate, is Congress going to be able to do anything to change the course in Iraq?
I think not without continuing pressure from the people. And the pressure from the people essentially has to be like the caller we just had a moment ago, who was, the Republican worried about the veterans. The president and the administration, I don't think, are feeling the pressure from the people to say, these are the specific things that are happening to our lives because of this. And the Congress, and with that, the only thing that could do is then lead Republicans in the House and in the Senate to move the other way. Seven Republicans in the Senate voted with the Democrats on Saturday. Of those, three or four, I have to do the math in my head quickly, are up for re-election this time, and they're getting a lot of pressure from back home. Senator Collins in Maine is one. Senator Coleman in Minnesota is a second. Senator Smith in Oregon is a third. I think there's a fourth. I just can't remember who it is. And until people, the other senators who are up for re-election beginning to say, this is the issue on which we're going to judge you, then I don't think that the Congress is going to be very powerful.
Yeah, but those elections are a ways off, too. So there's...
As we know, unfortunately, from the press every day, they're closer than we think.
Yeah, that's true. I suppose we are. At least we're talking about them right now. Well, Professor Maisel, thanks very much. We appreciate
your time.
It's
always a pleasure to be with you. I think your callers are the best in the nation.
I do, too. Thanks a lot. Sandy Maisel, professor of government at Colby College in Waterville, Maine. He is the director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement, author of many books. He is the author of Parties and Elections in America, The Electoral Process, and Running on Empty, Political Discourse in Congressional Elections. And we thank him for being with us, talking about what the House did on Friday, passing the non-binding resolution criticizing the troop surge in Iraq, the lack of action in the U.S. Senate on Saturday, and now what Congress is going to try to do next to try to change course in Iraq. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour. Thanks to Leo Duran for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. If you would like to purchase a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, please call the radio store. That number is 1-800-747-7444. 1-800-747-7444. You can also listen to our talk shows archived on our website. They are stored there for listening at your convenience. WPR.org, WPR.org. Thanks again for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.